This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Gabourey Sidibe, was so convincing in her first movie role that her performance was nominated for an Oscar, and a lot of her fans, like me, wondered if she was really like the character. In that 2009 film, Precious, Sidibe played a teenager who's sexually abused by her father and physically abused by her mother. She's overweight, illiterate, and has no friends, doesn't speak much, and when she does, it's the mumble of someone who doesn't want to be seen or heard. But Gabourey Sidibe, she's funny and smart and lively, as you're about to hear. That comes across in the subsequent role she's played in the TV series Empire, American Horror Story, The Big C, and Difficult People. It turns out she's a good writer, too. Her new memoir, This Is Just My Face, Try Not to Stare, has just been published. She writes about growing up in Brooklyn with a mother from the South and a father from Senegal. Her aunt co-founded Ms. Magazine. But Sidibe had to deal with a lot of fat shaming in school and a lot of anxiety and depression. She never expected to be an actress. I'll let Sidibe tell her story. Gabourey Sidibe, welcome to Fresh Air. I was so happy when I saw you in other roles after Precious and realized that you weren't Precious, that you were so full of energy. So how did you become Precious? And I don't mean how you were cast. I mean, how did you turn off that kind of life force that you have and become somebody who's been like so wounded by life that she's almost like turned herself off?
Yeah. Well, the thing about Precious is she's hiding. You know, she's hiding within herself. She is, you know, there's no safe place for her. She's not safe at school. She's not safe, you know, on her way to school. She's not safe at home more than anything. And so she's hiding, and there's a lot of pain there. And I think that is the most human part of that character. And that's the most human part of me. And the most human part of you and of everyone. We all can identify pain because we know pain. I would channel my pain between action and cut. And as soon as cut was called, I'd get out of it because it's too painful a place to stay. And so I somehow can, you know, access it and then shoo it away the second I don't need it anymore.
I interviewed Lee Daniels after Precious. And he told me that he'd called a casting director and said, I'm looking for a 350-pound black girl. And there was silence on the other end of the phone. And he approached people at McDonald's and at Radio Shack asking them to audition. He set up a Precious camp in which people who looked like they could play the part were given some training in how to act. And it just it wasn't working out until he found you. And he knew right away, because you were so lively and everything, that he knew right away that it was you, and that he was grateful to cast somebody who hadn't lived Precious's life, that he felt that it would somehow be exploiting somebody if they'd actually been Precious, but he didn't feel that way about you. Did he talk to you about that?
Yeah, I think a lot of why I got the role is because I wasn't this girl. And he really did think that he would be exploiting someone who was a lot like her. Because it's not about being that exact character. It's not about living that exact life. It's about understanding it and being able to mirror it. Because even though, look, a lot of what Hollywood is are interviews. It's this, you know, it's being able to go into a room and not be super emotional and be lively and be interesting to talk to. And that might not happen with someone who filmed a huge chunk of their life. There's an emotion tied to it that you can't turn off. I can turn it off because that's not my, I don't go home that way. I didn't grow up. I wasn't raised that way. And so, yeah, that would be exploitative, absolutely. And so I think a lot of the reason why he cast me is because he knew that I could turn it off.
Your mother, I don't know if she still does this, but she sang in subways.
She still does.
She still does?
Yeah.
Gosh. And she would often take you when you were a kid, and you'd be doing what while she was singing?
So she was a teacher up until she was a teacher in my school up until the fourth grade. She went on sabbatical and started singing the subway and found that she made more money singing in the subway than she did working for the Board of Education. And so
because teachers are so well paid.
Yeah. They have too much money. It's horrible. It's so bad. My mom would take my brother and I down to the subway while she sang. She'd sing, you know, 5 hours or so. And I would sit on the bench, either like somewhere in eyesight or definitely in earshot or something. And I would do my homework or I would read books. Penn Station in New York City, my mom would perform there, and there was a bookstore nearby. And so I would just wander around this huge train station, and I would go and sit down at a bookstore. And I think that they knew my mom because they would just let me pull a book off the shelves and read it without paying for it. And then every now and then I'd ask her for money. I really need this new Clue book, or I really need this new Nancy Drew. She made sure that I was always able to bury my nose deep in a book. And that's what I did while she sang to crowds and crowds of thousands of people every day.
So you write a lot about your mother in your book. You also write a lot about your father. He's from Senegal. His father was a politician who was mayor of the third largest city in Senegal. Your parents got married for the green card. Your father needed a green card. He offered your mother $4,000. She took it, although she told you it wasn't really for the money. She just wanted him to have a green card. And then they fell in love after the marriage, is how you describe it.
Yeah, I don't think she ever got the money. I think he offered it.
She didn't get money?
I'm not sure if she got any of it. But yeah, they were friends. And he did offer her money. But they got married. And I think she mostly married him because they were friends and she cared for him. And she thought she was doing him a favor. And yeah, a year after they were married, he took her home to Senegal to meet his family and to meet Africa the way, you know, a little black girl from the South in 1952 has never seen Africa. And she fell in love with him and he fell in love with her. And they decided to just, I guess, have a family. And pop, here I am.
So in talking more about your father, though, there were a lot of problems that he posed when you were growing up. He was very stern and maybe hit you sometimes. And you write that it was to make the point that you belonged to him, that you were, that the children were his property.
I think that culturally speaking, I'm black and you're white. And I've gotten this question from some people who happen to be white. I don't like to say Caucasian. It offends me. I'm joking. I was spanked by both my parents. There was someone wrote an article about, she was like, you were abused. And I was like, I wasn't abused. And she was like, I was abused. And I was like, you were abused. I wasn't abused. But she still wrote and said that I was abused. And I was like, I'm seeing that people, even though I've said, these are my words and this is my truth, people still see me and my truth through a filter of their own. But yes, my father was stern, but I spent this entire book trying to see my father, trying to really understand who he is. And at the end of the chapter where I wrote that, I go, you know, it must have been really, really hard for this African man with his African values and his African raising to work as a cab driver for, you know, 12 to 14 hours a day and come home to American children. We were children and we were a family that he did not understand. And he thought he had to be really strict on us because we were living in Bed-Stuy. You know, he lived in a part of Africa where, his father was the mayor and, you know, they would leave the doors open at night, just wide open at night. He lived in a safe place and we moved his family and we were living in a very unsafe place. And he thought that discipline was part of keeping us safe. And it was. Like there, I wrote a story that got edited out about how he would let me go get the mail just because I needed some independence. And I was like 6 years old. And my brother had so much independence. He was only 11 months older than me. But if I wanted to go check the mail, he would walk me to the door and he would watch me walk down the hallway and the elevator was around. And he'd tell me, don't get in the staircase. Do not get in the staircase. even if it was three floors, don't get in the staircase because bad things can happen to girls in the staircase. And he would wait for me to get on the elevator. I'd have to tell him I'm in the elevator because he couldn't see me. I'd have to yell, I'm in! And then I'd go down. He's like, you have 1 minute. Don't go anywhere. I'm counting 1 minute. And he's very stern in this way. And then I get the mail and I'm hurrying and I get back in the elevator because I'm not allowed to take the stairs. And as soon as the elevator opens on the third floor, I'd have to yell, I'm back! So that he can hear me. And then he's like, okay, come. But like, that was him. He was very stern, but he had to keep me safe because a little girl like me was not safe in the building that we lived in.
So you write in your book that you started noticing you were fat at age 6. What changed at age 6?
I think I just started realizing what people were saying, you know, what other kids were saying. You know, at 5, everybody's kind of like, everyone's still a kid at 5 years old. Like, anything's possible. I'm going to grow up and be Superman. But around 6, there's some weird shift that happens in the universe when you're 6 years old, where you're like, oh, maybe I can't fly. I can't fly and your nose is too big. You know, it's like that weird thing where, like, I realize this thing about myself. I'm not magic, so now I have to pick you apart, and I have to pick myself apart. And I think that was the age when people started calling me fatso and you this and you that, blah, blah, blah. That's what helped me to notice.
You write that you prayed to God that God would make you less sensitive. Yeah. Because of the way you were being mocked in school?
Absolutely. I didn't know then that I was having panic attacks, that I was dealing.
You were having panic attacks at age 6? Or 10?
I don't think I was praying to God to make me less sensitive then. I started praying to be less sensitive around fourth grade.
Mm-hmm.
Fourth grade, I think, with the dissolving of my parents' marriage. I was like a live nerve, you know. I just was, you know, unhinged. And I realized that when someone would say something mean to me, which was often, I would cry for hours, and my chest would close up, and I would really feel kind of like I was dying. Like, I can't believe this comment. You calling me a fatso is going to kill me right now. Why am I dying? And that wasn't until fourth grade, for sure. And that's when I started to pray. Okay, you cried from history through math and to gym. You cried for 3 hours today. We can't do this anymore. We can't cry for 3 hours. And you know that tomorrow they're just going to call you a fatso again. And you know it's going to make you cry. So please don't cry. Don't cry. And so I would pray to God that I could be less. I just thought I was being sensitive because that's what people told me. Oh, you're just a baby. You're being too sensitive. You're taking things to heart too much. And I thought that that's what it was. Nobody noticed that I was actually having a medical condition, that I was having, like, I was dealing with a mental disorder. I was dealing with depression and anxiety, and nobody noticed. And it continued through elementary, continued through junior high, continued in high school. I noticed that they were more prevalent on the way to school. And so I switched schools, and it happened even more. And I was like, this isn't tied to being called fat anymore. There's something else going on. And that's when I went to a doctor and said something. I realized while writing it, wow, is that why I was crying so much? Is that why my chest would close up and feel like my heart was beating too fast? I was having a panic attack at 9 damn years old and nobody saw me. And I remember my teacher, Mr. Maloff, who was really sexy. He was my science teacher and my homeroom teacher. My mom came to school for like teacher's night or whatever. And he was like, so she's great and she's really smart and she's really funny and everybody likes her. But if somebody says something mean about her, she starts crying and she cries for too long. And he like said, she cries for too long as if I could do something about it. I could not.
The worst thing when you're a kid and you're crying, in my opinion, is when your parent or an adult says, stop crying. It's like,
are you serious?
No, you're not controlling it. It's an involuntary response. You don't want to be crying.
Absolutely.
So it's just you're being criticized for doing something out of your control, which makes you cry more.
Cry even more. And yes. It's like, do you think I'm not in control of these emotions, fam? I'm not doing this. I'm embarrassed. I don't want to be doing this.
So you say in your book that during your period of depression, when before you had it under control, before you found the right therapist, the depression in your early 20s went along with a period of promiscuity that you call your hoe phase. And then after that, your therapist suggested you get a telemarketing job. And you did, but it was phone sex.
Yep.
And so
I was telling and marketing.
Yeah. So, like, that's theater, really. Like, was that good practice for becoming an actress?
Absolutely. It was good practice for this interview right now.
Wait a minute. What are you saying to me?
I'm saying you're
what
real
are you
sexy.
Telling me?
So what it is, you know, so yeah, phone sex is, I think you think that phone sex is about getting the caller off, mm-hmm. but it's about keeping the caller on. It's about leading with your personality and making sure that they're still listening to you, that they're still interested in you, because you cannot make money when they hang up.
Well, they pay by the minute.
Yeah, they pay by the minute. They pay by the minute, and I get paid by the minute. There's a base pay as long as you work in an office, which is different from doing phone sex from your house. That's your house. I'm not going to pay you to sit in your living room, but I'll pay you for the minutes that you're on the phone.
Did you have a persona or like sexy voice that you use?
Are you saying that my current voice isn't sexy?
I did not say that.
You should hear me order room service. Yeah, so my persona was Melody, who was also girl 1266, because I was a 1,266th employee. And so if I talked to you and you really liked me and you ever wanted to talk to me again, all you have to do is call back and dial 1266 for Melody. But also there were different voices for different characters and different lines that came through. So there was like the horny housewife or so. And so her voice was a little slower and a little more sultry and a little bit deeper. And then a dominant woman was even deeper and very, very, like, very, very strict and would only speak with purpose. And if I'm ever quiet on the line, that meant that I want you to make a different decision. But then there was like submissive girl, and she was kind of like a lost girl in the woods, and she just needed you to tell her to do everything. And then what do you want me to do? And then what do you want me to do? And I'll do anything you want.
When you were doing the phone sex, when you were the person on the phone, did you like the invisibility of it? Like, one of the things I've always loved about radio is that, like, you're invisible. People make you up visibly however they want to, especially before the days of the internet, mm-hmm. when anybody could access your picture whenever they wanted to. But did you like that invisibility where somebody could imagine you however they wanted their fantasy to look like?
It was kind of amazing. It was really interesting. There were a lot of things fighting with each other, positive and negative. I once went on a job interview. I went on like two or three job interviews before I got this job. And I remember feeling like, oh, I didn't get the job because I'm black. Or I didn't get the job because I'm fat. Something about my appearance makes me unemployable. And so going to this company where, unless otherwise specified, if you picked up the phone and you're a girl on the phone, you're 100% white. Unless there are different lines. There's like the black girl line, there's Latino girl line, and there's Asian girl line. And other than that, you are white.
So a lot of people assumed you were white.
Well, yeah, based on my voice. And I also would make my voice a little bit whiter. So, but like, we couldn't hire you if you had no ability to make your voice white. Now, because that's what the men on the phone wanted to talk to. That's who they wanted to talk to. Now, the company was ran by 95% plus size black women.
That's hilarious.
It's so interesting that, like, we vocally, you have no value unless you are white. But you're only smart enough to work here if you're a black woman. And we were all plus size, and none of, you know, these men would not normally be into us. And if they were, it's like it's a fetish or whatever. You know, if we wouldn't, you know, we're not seen as being beautiful and worthy of love in this weird way.
Can I say there's a lot of fat shaming surrounding sexuality?
So much, like an insane amount. And it's just like, fat black girl, these are obviously not my opinions on myself and people who look like me, but it's the world that I have to live in, their opinions, which sucks. And so it's very strange to go from undesirable into the office, you clock in and your voice is the most, and just, oh, I love you so much and I'll call you every every day. I love you so much. But they think I'm white and they think I'm young and they think I'm, you know, this thing. But I mean, I say in the book, like, you think you're talking to Megan Fox, but you're talking to Precious. And it was really weird. Just like, look how dope and fierce and amazing and smart and genius we are to fool you into thinking that we're the opposite, because the opposite is what you want. But really, I'm here all along. I'm still here.
I want to mention along these lines, in terms of like fat shaming surrounding sex, when you did the scene on Empire, mm-hmm. where it was a lovemaking scene, not explicit at all.
Mm-mm. We both had clothes on.
Yeah. I mean, there were some really nasty tweets about that.
Yeah.
I don't even know what to say.
I wasn't necessarily surprised by the mean tweets because, you know, I kind of get them quite a bit. And thankfully, at that time, I was writing the recaps for each Empire episode for, I think, Entertainment Weekly. And so I knew people would have something to say. And so I decided to say something about it. And I think before it came out, like, somebody had written an article about why it was here. And I was like, I don't need you to talk for me. Because there's value in my own voice, and I knew that. And so I wrote something, and I was like, you know, it's strange that people are so shocked to see someone like me have a makeout session. Like, do you think that I don't deserve love or that I don't get love? Like, I mean, like, and I said to him, I was like, you watch Maury. Big people have relationships all the time. Like, what are you talking about? And it was kind of groundbreaking. The thing is, like, I and Mo McRae, who played Becky's love interest, were both dark-skinned people. And there's never been a love scene between two dark-skinned people, let alone one of them being plus size on primetime television, where it was not a joke, you know?
Is that true?
Find it. I remember the DP, our DP Jody, came over after we shot, and he's like, that's beautiful. He's like, I've never seen anything like this. I'm so grateful to be a part of this, because it was a big deal. And for people to say, oh, that's disgusting, or like, this is irrelevant, or like, how, and I can't even get a text back or whatever. And it's like, so you were much more comfortable seeing me and my body be raped and Precious by my father than this tender, lovely moment of just making out. It wasn't explicit at all. But, like, are you saying that I don't deserve love just because of the body I'm in? I wouldn't say that to you. That's horrible. I wouldn't do that to you. I deserve love. People like me deserve love because we're human. Why would you take that away from me?
Because of Twitter.
because Twitter. Somebody was like, what's your favorite thing about Twitter? And I was like, Twitter. And they're like, what's the worst thing about Twitter? And I was like, Twitter. Twitter is horrible and amazing.
Well, Gabrielle Sidibe, congratulations on finding your path, on your acting career, and on the new memoir. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Gabrielle Sidibe's new memoir is called This Is Just My Face. Try Not to Stare. In 2010, writer Rakesh Sathyal won the Lambda Literary Award for Gay Debut Fiction for his novel Blue Boy. His new novel is called No One Can Pronounce My Name, which our book critic Maureen Corrigan says is a misleading title. Here's her review.
Rakesh Sathyal's new novel checks off a lot of boxes, but its charm lies in the fact that it wears all of its various identities so lightly. This is an immigration story, a coming out story, and something of an old school feminist story about a timid woman learning to roar. Yet there's nothing preachy or predictable about Sathyal's novel. Rather, the most cumbersome thing about it is its title, which I've delayed saying for as long as possible. It's called No One Can Pronounce My Name, which sounds aggrieved, when instead this is a novel that invites readers to be amused. Sathyal wants us all to laugh together about the comedy of errors that often typifies everyday life. No One Can Pronounce My Name is set in an Indian American community in suburban Cleveland, Ohio. Ranjana is a middle-aged wife and mother whose son has just departed for college, Princeton no less. Ranjana's husband is an out-of-shape academic who sports what she thinks of as the common Indian male physique, second trimester, with a possible sale into the third. For years, Ranjana has lived a secret life. She writes erotic supernatural fiction, modeled on the work of Anne Rice. Ranjana first read Interview with a Vampire when she and her husband emigrated to America. We're told it was her way of trying to permeate the wall that separated her Indian life from the omnipresent glitz of American pop culture. Now, though, with her son off at college, Ranjana's days are too solitary in her empty house. So she takes a job as a receptionist in an Indian proctologist's office. This job, along with her participation in what turns out to be a vicious writer's group, are Ranjana's tentative ways of trying to enter a wider world. The other main character here, also a middle-aged Indian immigrant, is even more adrift. Harith lives with his mother, who's deranged by grief for his older sister, the victim of a stupid, deadly accident. To comfort his mother, whose eyesight is conveniently dimmed by cataracts, Harith dresses up every night in his dead sister's saris and pretends to be her. In ways Harith dare not name even silently to himself, this dress-up game has become consoling to him, too. Clothes also become the conduit for leading Harith out of his isolation. He lands a job in the men's accessories department, called Men's Furnishings, at the quaint Harriman's department store. There, an older gay man named Teddy takes Harith under his wing and introduces him to the cheering ritual of happy hour at TGI Fridays in a nearby mall. But not everyone at Harriman's is so welcoming. Here's Sathyal's description of the daily dynamics in the employee break room. By 8:30, the 15 or so salespeople of the morning shift would gather and loiter with their coffees, bagels, stinky fast food breakfasts, and gossip. It wasn't that they were mean to Harith, but except for a smile in passing or an odd question about his ethnicity, "In India, do you drink 8 glasses of tea a day instead of water?" they rarely engaged him directly in conversation. Both Ranjana and Harith pine for some kind of deep connection to other human beings, but they're clueless as to how to make that happen. Their shared situation may sound glum, but "Because No One Can Pronounce My Name" is essentially and delightfully a comic novel, the intertwined plots here are buoyant rather than blue. It says something about both the reach of Sathyal's story and his wry skill as a storyteller that while I was reading, I kept thinking of Barbara Pym, who wrote mostly about the lives of tweedy English spinsters with similar warmth and humor. No One Can Pronounce My Name explores the politics of sexual identity, as well as the immigrant and first-generation American experience. But unfashionable as it may sound, the novel's greater achievement lies in the compassionate, comic way it explores the universal human experience of loneliness.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed No One Can Pronounce My Name by Rakesh Sathyal. My guest, Rhiannon Giddens, has a beautiful voice and is about to sing for us. She brought her banjo to the studio. Her new album, Freedom Highway, her second solo album, includes songs she wrote based on slave narratives. Also on the album is her song, Better Get It Right the First Time, which she wrote in response to police shootings of young black men. Giddens has a personal and music background that crosses boundaries. She grew up in North Carolina. Her mother is African American. Her father is white. He sang classical music. Giddens studied opera at Oberlin. But she found her music identity after graduation when she started playing string band music from the African American tradition, songs from the 1920s and 30s. She co-founded the string band The Carolina Chocolate Drops. She's now branching out into acting. She has a recurring role on the TV series Nashville, playing a social worker who sings in her church choir. Let's start with a track from Gidden's new album, Freedom Highway. This is one of her songs inspired by slave narratives. It's called Come Love Come.
My loving man was cornered by the boss's man. She turned her head and got struck down. They buried her.
Rhiannon Giddens, welcome back to Fresh Air. Tell us about the slave narrative that the song we just heard is based on.
Well, that one in particular is actually kind of based on an amalgam of stories that I was reading. Just sort of the usual, I hesitate to say that word, but the usual experiences of a lot of people back then. And it takes all of those and puts them into one life, you know, the loss of parents, whether by death or by them being sold away, that breaking up of the family is in there, the first two verses. And then the whole idea of the one day a week marriage, you know, if you married somebody who was on another plantation, you only got to be together for one day a week, you know. And of course, that marriage wasn't even legal. It's like your own cultural marriage, you know, jumping the broom. So I put all of that into one life.
What got you into reading slave narratives and thinking you'd base some songs on them?
You know, getting into the banjo and discovering that it was an African-American instrument, you know, just it totally turned on its head my idea of American music. And then through that, American history.
So you describe your banjo as a minstrel-era banjo, so a replica of a minstrel-era banjo. So what makes this banjo different than other banjos?
Well, you know, the original banjos were all handmade instruments. They would have been made with gourds and in whatever, you know, materials would have been around. And, you know, the first 100 years of its existence, the banjo was known as a plantation instrument, as a black instrument. And the sound of it is the sound of the original banjo. I mean, it's that deep, really deep, beautiful,
it is,
you know,
deep
thing.
It's deeper than I'm used to hearing. And the way that you play it, parts of the album are really haunted. I mean, you're talking about slavery, you're talking about death, you're writing songs about, you know, mothers who have to give up their children. So it, and your singing has a haunted quality, but so does the banjo. And I want you to, and you have your banjo, maybe you could perform for us another song that you do on your album, Freedom Highway. And this is called The Purchaser's Option. And this is based on an ad that you saw, a historical ad for a slave that was going to be sold. So this was the owner taking out an ad.
Yeah, that was a, you know, a lot of people, you know, we like to think that slavery only existed in the South, but, you know, up until a certain point, it was all over, you know, the United States at that point where, you know, the fledgling United States. And, you know, a lot of people, majority of slave owners only had two or three or, you know, even one or two enslaved people in their households, and they were a form of wealth. So if somebody had, you know, needed some money, they would sell somebody. I mean, that's just kind of how it was. So they put an ad in the paper and they'd get their cash. I mean, for me, that whole story, it just shows the absolute commonplaceness of it, which also shows how horrible that is, you know, that's commonplace. And this ad really killed me because at the end of it, it says she has with her a 9-month-old baby who was at the purchaser's option. And I just started thinking about what this young woman, what her life was really like, you know, not having any agency over any part of her life. Like, we take that for granted. Like, I have two children, and I'm like, I don't have to worry about them being sold away from me or taken away, you know? and just how do you make it through that?
So the purchaser's option in this context meant that if you buy this woman who's a slave, you have the option of buying or not buying her baby along with her.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
It's just, oh, it gives me the creeps just even talking about it now, even though I've been singing the song now ever since. But
can I ask you to sing it for us?
Yeah. I've got a babe, but shall I keep him? 'Twill come the day when I'll be weeping. But how can I love him any less? This little babe upon my breast. You can take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul. You can take my body, take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul. A body dark and strong. I was young, but not for long. You took me to bed, a little girl. Left me in a woman's world. You can take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul. You can take my body, you can take my bones, take my blood, but not my soul. You can take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul. You can take my body, take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul.
Thank you for doing that. That song is really chilling. I want to talk with you about your life, and I want to quote something that you've said, which is, I am a daughter of the South, of the white working class, of the black working class, of the Democrats and the Republicans, of the gay and the straight. Is that all literally true?
Yep.
Let's go through it.
Sure. I mean, I ended up moving to Greensboro, but I spent the first part of my life with my grandparents out in the country. So my mom's folks are from one side of Greensboro and, outside of Greensboro. And then my dad's folks, the white side, is from another very small town outside of Greensboro. And, my dad's side, I'd say a lot of those folks are a lot more conservative and would be Republican. And us coming into that family was very interesting.
You mean the black side out of your family?
Yes,
right.
Yes, the colored yeah. girls. Yes, uh-huh. Me and my sister. I find the story really beautiful because the fact that my parents came together in Greensboro, they went to college and found each other in Greensboro, the big city, and created these two, me and my sister, and got married, and these two families had to deal with that. And of course the black side a lot more easier knowing how to deal with the white folks, because that's kind of, what you have to do. But my dad's folks, like, not knowing quite what to do with me and my sister, and for me that the story is really beautiful and it is the way that we change things is that sometimes it just takes one person. And that, and in that family, it was my grandmother, my dad's mom. My sister was her first grandchild, and she had a choice. She was like, I can treat this child differently, or I can just treat this child like I love them because they're my grandchild. And that's what she did. And she set this tone, that was like, these are my grandchildren. And it was just this love. She was just made of love. And I really feel like one person can make a huge difference if they just like believe what their heart tells them. And, my mom's parents loving my dad and just bringing him in and you know, there was a lot of that going on. And this is the middle of North Carolina in the 70s. You know, I mean, they couldn't even get married in Greensboro. I mean, it's just...
They couldn't get married in Greensboro?
Yes, that's what I was told. Like, they had to go to Winston to get married. I mean, this is 3 years after the Loving decision.
They got 3 years after the Supreme Court decision that made it, that outlawed all of the anti-miscegenation laws, the laws that made it impossible, like illegal for black and a white person to marry.
Yeah, I mean,
I still can marry. That's amazing.
You know, it just blows my mind to think about that, to think that 3 years before they got married, it wouldn't have been legal. I mean, that just, it blows my mind, you know?
So, you know, in terms of that identity statement that I read, the part about that you're the daughter of the gay and the straight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mom, she's had a partner for many years, my other mom, and I got a lot of moms, and they recently got married in North Carolina now that it's legal, hopefully will continue to be, and I grew up, you know, because obviously my mom and my dad got divorced when I was very, very young, and that's just been part of my life, you know. I've never really thought about it. It's just...
How old were you when
my
mom, when she came out?
I don't know if she's ever, like, announced. She just lived her life. I think there was one day I realized, like, oh, that's mom's girlfriend.
So you were still
you know
a child.
I mean? Yeah, I was still a child, but I was just like, it didn't mean anything to me other than just that was who she was, you know?
So you studied opera, and in spite of the fact that your music is, you know, out of various folk traditions, and also country music and some gospel you've sung. But you went to Oberlin and studied opera there. Given that's not the direction you ended up taking, why did you decide to study opera?
I decided to study music my last year in high school, and I didn't really know much about opera. I had one CD, a compilation CD that I loved, and I knew that they didn't speak on stage. And I went, they sing all the time. That sounds really cool. I want to do opera. I mean, that's literally, that was my choice. You know, I just had this fear of speaking on stage. So I went with opera.
Technically, what's the difference between your opera voice and your other voice?
It's interesting. It's like I'm placing it in different part of my head. You know, so when I'm singing, you know, da, 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 dee, da, da. It's all up here. But then if I'm, you know, Creole babies walk along with rhythm in their thighs, rhythm in their hips and in their lips and in their eyes. I mean, it's it's in a different place, you know. So I'm doing all these different things with my mouth and where, with my placement, but all the breath is the same.
Right, and that second song was Underneath the Harlem Moon.
Yeah.
Ethel Waters made famous.
Yes, and made changes to, yeah. And we do her version, you know, the words that she added to that song. But yeah, and you know, and then when you're doing, you know, when I first come to this country in 1849, that's very compressed and is up, you know, right behind my nose. You know, so they all have different places that they live.
And that was more kind of like folk and
kind of Appalachian.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you for illustrating that. One of the slave narrative songs on your new album, Freedom Highway, is called Julie. It's a dialogue between a slave and the woman who owns her. And the woman who owns her is afraid that Julie, the slave, is going to run off with the Union soldiers when they come. So the slave owner is trying to convince Julie to, like, stay. I'm going to ask you to sing the ending of the song, but can you tell us more of the story leading up to the end so that we get what's happening?
Yeah, so back then, a lot of times, plantation owners would try to hide the wealth of the plantation in slave cabins, you know, and with the enslaved people. And I have to say, I'm finding a lot of strength and power in not saying slave and saying enslaved person. I read a book called The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. And throughout this book, he makes this change. And it really makes a difference in how you look at it, because you're not born a slave. You know, you're born a person and somebody decides to enslave you. It is done to you. It is not an integral part of who you are. So that's something I'm trying to change in my, as I think about it, because I found that change really powerful. So anyway, this conversation that was overheard, that was then written down, that I read and then turned into this song, Julie, was a mistress and the woman that she thinks that she owns, you know, and they're watching the Union Army come over the hill, and the mistress is like, you know, you're not going to leave me, are you? And the woman is like, yeah, I'm out of here, you know, and the mistress can't understand this, you know. And they get to this point where she wants her to hide the wealth of the plantation. And I'll sing, you know, what happens. Julie, oh Julie, can't you lie? If they find that trunk of gold by my side, Julie, oh Julie, you tell them men that that trunk of gold is yours, my friend. Mistress, oh mistress, I won't lie. If they find that trunk of gold by your side, mistress, oh mistress, that trunk of gold is what you got when my children you sold. Mistress, oh mistress, don't you cry. The price of staying here is too high. Mistress, oh mistress, I wish you well. But in leaving here, I'm leaving hell.
Rhiannon Giddens, it's just been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much for singing for us. And I really love the new album, so thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Rhiannon Giddens' new solo album is called Freedom Highway. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.
Day three, with not one thought of you. And I see a crooked smile that draws me back.